Good day, and welcome to the D. Gardiner Industrial Energy Efficiency and the CPP Tools for State conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Jennifer Kiefer. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you so much to everyone who's joining, and it looks like folks keep rolling in. I'm going to open up with just a moment of housekeeping and then just a quick overview of what we hope to cover during the next hour. But then I'm hoping to save most of our time for our expert presenters to tell you about the various tools that they have developed for states to incorporate industrial energy efficiency into the Clean Power Plan. First, with respect to housekeeping, all of your lines are muted, but that doesn't mean we don't want to have a two-way conversation. We encourage folks to click on the Q&A button at the top of your screen at any time to submit questions. We will compile the questions and hopefully have some time to address them at the close of our presentation today. And then for any questions we do not have time to address today on this call, we will be responding by email with you offline. So even given our limited time, I certainly encourage you to ask questions. I also want to let folks know that a recording of today's call and links to all the slides will be available, and we will follow up with those resources as well. If anybody is joining today's call that did not register through Eventbrite and you still are interested in receiving those materials, please do send me a note at jennifer@dgardiner.com, and my email address will be included in the final slide during the Q&A. I'll remind folks about that then as well. I'd now like to take just a few minutes for a very quick overview about what we're hoping to cover during the next hour. First, as all of you know, EPA is expected to issue the final Clean Power Plan as soon as next week, which will be setting the first ever carbon limits on power plants. While EPA will be setting targets in the plan, states are going to have flexibility to determine the best way to reach those limits. And even though at this point we don't know exactly what will be in the rule, we do anticipate that as in the proposed rule, states will continue to be able to look outside the four walls of the power plant to find the best way to reduce their emissions. All of the presenters on today's call recognize that energy efficiency is one of the lowest cost ways to achieve those emissions limits. What's more, energy efficiency offers a whole suite of supportive or complementary benefits. It saves costs for our manufacturers and makes them more competitive. It will help make our grid more reliable and more resilient. And it will help reduce bills for homeowners, businesses, and for manufacturers. This opportunity for energy efficiency is big. In fact, nationwide, we can achieve 600 million tons of carbon reductions using a set of just four well-established energy efficiency policies, as you'll hear more about during one of our presentations this afternoon. Those investments will save money for all ratepayers by reducing their bills and helping the economy by creating jobs. In 2030, energy efficiency could save ratepayers more than $360 billion in electricity costs and create more than 600,000 jobs in the design, construction, installation, and maintenance of equipment. Industrial efficiency holds particular promise for manufacturers who can reduce their energy use through combined heat and power and other forms of industrial efficiency investments. Now, manufacturers have already made significant progress in reducing their energy use, but studies show us that the industrial sector could still reduce electricity by as much as 30%. This would make manufacturers more competitive by reducing their costs while cutting emissions. After all, it's common sense that you're going to save money if you can make cans and bottles using less energy. And less electricity means lower emissions. For instance, a typical combined heat and power plant can produce electricity with one-half the emissions of conventional power generation. Today's panelists agree that states should take advantage of this opportunity and include industrial efficiency in their plans. Today's webinar will highlight a few tools that will help guide states in doing that. We're going to kick things off with Ken Colburn, who's a principal for the Regulatory Assistance Project and who worked on behalf of the National Association of Clean Air Agencies, or NACA, to develop a menu of options for states that lays out the various technologies available to states and approaches available to states to reduce their emissions. Ken will be followed by Negan Kelly, a research analyst at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, or ACEEE. Megan is going to be describing a whole suite of tools that ACEEE has developed over the last year to help states determine the scale of the energy efficiency opportunity for their state and pathways for including several energy efficiency policies in their compliance plans. And then finally, Bruce Hedman, Technical Director at the Institute for Industrial Productivity, will describe a report that was released just last week with IIP and David Gardner and Associates on behalf of the American Gas Association, American Chemistry Council, and the Forest and Paper Association, which details considerations around including combined heat and power in particular in state plans. Of course, some of those considerations may evolve after the rule is published, but Bruce's remarks will highlight some of the factors that states will need to keep in mind. Given how much we have to cover, I'm going to be collecting questions throughout the call, but addressing them at the conclusion of the presentation. I just want to make sure that we have time for all of our speakers to present. And again, as I said before, I do encourage you to submit questions throughout the call. If we don't have time on this webinar to address them, we will compile questions and address them offline afterward. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to Ken Colburn with the Regulatory Assistance Project, who will speak about the menu of options he helped develop for NACA.
Thanks very much, Jen. I'm delighted to be with you all today, and you've already given a good introduction about what I'll talk about, so let me move right into it. I do want to start, though, by indicating certainly for those members from states that are on the call, state regulators, but also those of you who will be dealing with state regulators in case they're thinking too narrowly, a reminder that this is not a SIP. The Clean Power Plan is being developed under Section 111 of the Clean Air Act, which provides substantially greater flexibility to state air regulators in preparing compliance plans. Unfortunately, as a result of that being 111D, state regulators have relatively little experience with it, and something similar to 111D does not require to be, something similar to Section 110, which air regulators do have a lot of experience with, does not mean that they need to follow a Section 110 approach. So states have little experience with 111 in terms of the cost and useful life considerations that it has, what measures, timing, and contents of state plans should look like. What about multi-state options? You recall that about the Ozone Transport Commission was virtually the only multi-state effort under the Clean Air Act, perhaps the Western Regional Air Partnership. So this is pretty new turf as well. And then, of course, the federal response when the state plan is deemed to be deficient. So the key point is that states can approach this as though it's a SIP, but in doing so, they'll likely be more constrained and face higher costs, fewer options, and less innovation as a result. So do indeed think more broadly, which is what 111 provides. To add an illustration of that, you're all familiar with the four building blocks that EPA used to determine state target figures, and most thinking has one way or another mashed those four blocks together to determine state plans. What we're urging through the NACA menu is that you think in terms of broader opportunities beyond those four building blocks. This is particularly important now that energy efficiency may or may not be used by EPA in setting targets. It will still be used as a compliance option. So states can and should think outside of the EPA blocks, and better that you imagine and innovate what's the best option profile for your state and then seek EPA's approval of that rather than asking Mother May I every step of the way. Now, in terms of the menu of options, Jen indicated that NACA recently released, it was mid or late May, a 465-page document covering a variety of technology and policy options that states can undertake to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The document was actually outlined and engineered even before the proposed 111D rule was released, so it includes a number of options and is in no way wedded to EPA's four building blocks. I'll cover a few of those today that most directly relate to industrial energy efficiency. Many, of course, relate to grid operations or residential and commercial opportunities and not so much apply. In terms of the contents of each of those chapters, we do cover a profile, a description of the opportunity, its regulatory backdrop, how it works, and then where it has been implemented, what the experience has been in state and local jurisdictions, what kinds of emission reductions one might anticipate, and maybe additional co-benefits. the cost associated with them, and then other considerations. Sometimes there are unintended consequences or whatnot. We also provide where to go next to turn for additional information, because while these chapters are on the order of 20 or 30 pages each, they are not state-specific, exhaustive, turnkey analyses for individual states. And then of course, a summary. Let me look with you at five or six of those chapters. One of the most important for you all, Jennifer alluded to, is combined heat and power. It says combined heat and power in other sectors because there are CHP opportunities within the power sector, inside defense, if you will, as well. These are referring instead to those outside of power plants, which we more normally think of when we think in terms of CHP. And I'm sure everyone on the call recognizes the improved competitiveness that results from two uses of the same fuel. CHP is also host-dependent rather than utility or regional in nature, and it's certainly scalable, adds a lot of reliability costs and multiple pollutant reduction benefits. Chapter 11 is about establishing energy efficiency or energy savings targets. Energy efficiency, as Jennifer indicated, is a low-cost resource. Several states have done energy efficiency resource standards, and they've been remarkably successful, not only in reducing emissions, but also in stimulating job growth and providing economic benefits to the state. Typically, they've been ratepayer-funded, but there are significant additional opportunities in that direction and through other means as well. A couple of other chapters are fostering new markets for energy efficiency. This builds on the EERS chapter with voluntary and market-based opportunities, and they come in all flavors, technology, operational, behavioral, so forth, and are almost only limited to the imagination. They could include such things as audits and energy savings contracts, private efficiency, tax incentives, labeling programs, ability to compete in wholesale markets where there are organized markets, and so on. We're all aware of clean distributed generation. That's another opportunity. Close to the host facilities, often renewables, but not always. These facilities can avoid a lot of the transmission and distribution line losses, and in terms of their cost, they're increasingly cost competitive. So that's another way that industrial facilities can potentially comply or help comply with clean power plan obligations of states. Demand response is a very promising arena itself and is likely to focus initially at least on the industrial sector as well. This is where you have modification of load by the industrial end user. This is not news. For ages now, there have been peak targeting efforts at curtailment primarily, but these are becoming sophisticated control opportunities now that can not only shave peak, but even provide ancillary services. This will promote economic efficiency in wholesale markets and reduce costs and facilitate renewable energy integration as well. So multiple wins this through this route. And then Chapter 26 relates to emerging technologies and policies that perhaps have not yet been implemented as a state program or are simply around the bend, but we thought were worth mentioning because they're not too far off. And these are things like the smart grid and Internet of Things, storage, of course, if you're all well aware, the changing business models of electric utilities and electricity distribution, opportunities for aggregation, electric vehicles, the whole water energy nexus issues, and so forth. A key point to take away from this is that while we have in the electric power system historically only managed supply to meet current demand, in future, demand will also be managed, so it really will be a trading platform kind of situation. I want to emphasize that states and those with compliance obligations should think in terms of co-benefits as well. This is such a big and groundbreaking, if you will, rule that we tend to think of it as the last one we'll ever face, which, of course, is certainly not the case. This little two-by-two matrix illustrates air quality benefits up and detriments down, and climate benefits right and detriments left. And, of course, where one wants to be is where all of those things occur, all of the benefits are achieved. So the point is that good, clean power plant choices can help air quality as well, and vice versa. Ditto for water. RAP has done some thinking on this as to how air quality planning and energy planning, IRP, could be integrated, and have a draft paper out for comment critique at that website. I mentioned privately delivered energy efficiency earlier. This graph from Bloomberg shows the utility programs in blue and energy service companies, ESCOs, activities in purple. You see that they're virtually equivalent. It's about a $7 billion market now that doesn't rely on state or utility investments, projected to double in the next few years. And it's not even clear that industrial activity is represented in either of those slices very accurately. So you don't want to lose out on emissions reductions associated with industrial efficiency. You may need to be proactive in that respect. Hence the question, how's your state dealing with those issues? Energy efficiency probably won't be easy under the Clean Power Plan because even though 111D has more flexibility, EPA has not been used to exercising that flexibility, just as states haven't. So RAPs have been working with EPA closely on several ways, several of them named here, that EPA could more adroitly recognize emission reductions from efficiency. In the interest of time, I needn't go through them all, but would be pleased to cover in more detail if you have questions or where there might be interest offline as well. Key things to remember, I'll just cite the bottom two, that rule effectiveness is typically imposed on any state regulation, even if it's a federally dictated one, and that provides a margin of error. You know, if the state is estimating 100% reductions or a certain amount of tons, then it's often the case that EPA counts only on the order of 80% of that going forward until the state proves otherwise. It can do the same thing with efficiency, and once again, because 111D provides greater flexibility, EPA should have greater flexibility to do so, thus encouraging efficiency. In terms of tracking emissions reductions associated with efficiency, this is a map of existing renewable energy track programs in the country, and those can quite easily be modified to include energy efficiency as well. So tracking to avoid double counting should not be an obstacle. The bottom line, I think this is Lazard's recent levelized cost of energy, and you see efficiency on the lower right corner as lowest cost. So that means if your state doesn't have energy efficiency prominent in its Clean Power Plan compliance planning, then it doesn't have a least cost plan. That's not where any of us should want to be. Contact information, but Jen said that she'll make these all available. So I'll turn it over right over to Megan Kelly from ACEEE. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
All right. Thanks again. Just go ahead and get started. Here's a quick intro about ACEEE. We're a nonprofit organization headquartered in Washington, D.C., and we conduct research on end-use energy efficiency programs and policies and technologies. I want to give you a snapshot of some of ACEEE's 111D-related work so far. We released a study that we call Changes in the Air that came out actually before the draft rule, where we evaluated potential energy and CO2 savings from energy efficiency policies on a state-by-state basis. We also submitted comments to EPA during the comment period where we made some recommendations on how to strengthen the final rule, and we submitted joint comments with several energy efficiency organizations focused on EM&V. We've participated in meetings convened by the so-called 3N group made up of those associations listed there on the slide, and we've participated in meetings with other stakeholders as well. Now, much of our work is focused on providing technical assistance to states, which is what I'm going to talk to you about today. So I'll tell you about three tools that ACEEE has produced to help states with clean power plan strategy and planning. Our state and utility pollution reduction calculator, which will help states estimate how much savings and at what cost different compliance options offer. The second tool is a compliance template series, which we developed to help states document energy efficiency measures in a state plan. And I will mention a joint state 111D resource hub that is led by NASIO, the National Association of State Energy Officials, which provides an online platform to help states access information about how to use energy efficiency in a state plan. So by the end of this, it's my hope that you'll be aware of some new helpful resources that are freely available. Let's start with the State and Utility Pollution Reduction Calculator, also known as SUPER. And the purpose of SUPER is to assist states in understanding the cost and pollution reduction potential of different compliance scenarios. So it's an Excel-based tool that will provide kind of first-order of magnitude estimates. And it's meant to be simple enough that really any stakeholder weighing options for clean power plan compliance can use it. There are some other tools like SUPER that are available, and this one is different in a couple of ways, but I'll just point out here that we think it provides kind of the granularity on energy efficiency policy options, and it also emphasizes accessibility for the user. So the way SUPER works is by first allowing the user to select their states and then build a scenario. There are 19 different policy options, including energy efficiency, renewable energy, natural gas, nuclear, and then there are some traditional emission control options. And the calculator will provide results in terms of pollutants reduced, energy saved, and costs, assuming that those measures begin in 2016 and then continue through 2030. This is a screenshot from SUPER, and I know that it's fuzzy and you can't read it clearly, but don't worry because I'm going to show you something better in just a minute. But I wanted to give an idea of what the interface looks like. So you select your state there in the yellow box at the top. The measures that a user chooses are listed beneath there in the blue box. There's a table with some helpful definitions, a table that summarizes results in 2020, 2025, and 2030, and then some helpful context about what these results might mean in terms of power plants avoided or progress toward your state's emission targets. So the calculator has more tabs with more detailed information and some nice visual results, and instead of showing you fuzzy screenshots of those, I'll invite you to download the tool and try it out for yourself. I used some results from SUPER to demonstrate how a state might use it to evaluate some energy efficiency options. And here's a graph that uses results from SUPER to show the impact that a suite of efficiency measures could have on a state target that EPA set in the draft rule. So this graph shows results for five different states across the horizontal axis, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, Mississippi, and Pennsylvania. And the solid green bar shows each state's emissions reduction target expressed as a percentage. So Illinois is required to reduce its emissions statewide by 42%, Ohio 29%, so on. In SUPER, I chose four policies, a 1.5% energy savings target, otherwise known as an EERS, and this would include savings from the industrial sector, CHP, the impact of building energy codes, and then savings from ESCO programs. So all of the impacts of those policies are stacked up in the multicolored bar next to the state's EPA goal, and we can see that those policies make up a lot, if not all, of a state's target. So, for example, this suite of policies could help the state of Illinois get 74% of the way towards their target. We can also use SUPER to evaluate a single policy. So here's an example of how a state could look at whether or not CHP might be an attractive option. The calculator for combined heat and power offers a low, medium, and high option. I chose the high option. It reflects the installation of 500 megawatts split evenly between the commercial and industrial sectors. So SUPER here is demonstrating how far the installation of 500 megawatts of CHP could get the state towards its target. So this means that we estimate Illinois could get 6% of the way towards its target using CHP, and so on down the line. And I want to point out that any state could potentially install more CHP than 500 megawatts, and in that case, a user would select the CHP high option more than once. So it will the tool will allow you to select up to 10 policies. With that, I'm just going to switch gears to the second tool that I wanted to talk about today, which is our compliance template series. So to create the templates, we looked at existing EPA guidance,
language in the proposed rule and our experience with energy efficiency for air quality. They represent our best guess at how a state might document energy efficiency policies in a state plan. So while 111D is different from the traditional SIP process, as Ken pointed out, not a SIP, we think there still may be some useful information on what mechanisms we might use to document efficiency in an air quality context. So the templates are not a definitive approach, but they're our best effort to provide some certainty for states with the information that we have now. Each template includes background on some of the key components that we think have to be addressed in a plan, a list of all the different elements, instructions for how to address those elements, and then a hypothetical submission or a case study where we actually write out some sample language. And so far, we've developed templates on building codes, energy efficiency financing programs, and combined heat and power, which is the template that I worked on. And my colleagues here are working now on a template for documenting an energy savings target and multifamily programs. To give a little example, in the CHP template, these are the seven elements that we think need to be addressed, and we provide some recommendations on how to provide answers. So we include a discussion on some CHP program options that a state might include in a plan. We also discuss how to quantify emissions benefits from CHP. In the template, we suggest a method for estimating energy savings, and we provide a sample calculation in the appendix. And we worked in consultation with Bruce Hedman at the Institute for Industrial Productivity. He'll present next. He was very helpful to us in developing the methodology, and we hope it's helpful to states as well. So we briefly discussed the rest of these elements, how to report on implementation, how to report on performance, et cetera. Some reviewers found the case study at the end to be the easiest part of the template to understand. In the CHP template, we provide sample language based on a scenario where the state of Mississippi seeks credit for a CHP program in their plan, and the case study is short. It's only 5 pages, so we think it really shows that including CHP in a state plan is doable. Finally, I'll mention the last resource, the State 111D Resource Hub, and this is hosted by NASIO in partnership with ACEEE. And the purpose of the site is to act as a clearinghouse for resources that will help states and help state agencies as they consider options for 111D compliance. It has a broad array of resources. NACA's menu of options is available there. There are resources from RAP, resources for the futures primers there. Probably a link to this very webinar will be there once it's available. So we hope that any stakeholder that's interested in energy efficiency as a compliance strategy will access the site and locate these reports. And in the future, we hope that the hub will become an even greater resource. NASIO, ACEEE, and RAP are exploring the opportunity to expand the site with a vision of providing a Q&A-type forum where states can post questions and ask for help. So stay tuned on that. And this is a review of the tools that I mentioned today, so you can access them. It's not only our hope that states will utilize these tools, but we hope that industrial customers, too, will use information from these tools to open a dialogue with states about working together. My contact information is here, and also contact information for Sarah Hayes, who is out on maternity leave for just a couple more weeks, but she leads ACEEEE's work on 111D and led the development of a lot of these tools that I talked about today. So with that, I will turn it over to Bruce Hedman with Institute for Industrial Productivity.
Megan, thank you. Let me move to the next slide. All right, works. Thanks, Megan. I'm going to take the next 12 minutes or so and just take a little bit deeper dive into one of the industrial efficiency measures, combined heat and power, and really talk about a resource that was released, as Jennifer said, just last week, that provides some additional guidance for states on how to incorporate CHP into their compliance plans. The report, again, as Jennifer said, was a joint product of the Institute for Industrial Productivity and David Gardner and Associates. It was sponsored by the American Gas Association, the American Chemistry Council, and the American Forest and Paper Association. And it really is intended to provide tools, information, and identify resources that states can use to evaluate CHP as a compliance option and help them really move through incorporating it into their plan. I think it's important to state that the report, the template, does not really endorse any particular approach for any state. Actual state plans are going to vary dependent upon state-specific factors and determinations. Every policy option identified in the report is not appropriate for every state. But we do hope it's a useful resource to get states started as they evaluate policies and actions that could promote investment in CHP and how a CHP pathway can be designed to meet the basic requirements for an EPA-approved compliance plan. Because I saw on the pre-registration that we really have quite a broad audience signed up for this webinar, so I'm going to first start with a few slides on why CHP ought to be at least looked at as states are developing their compliance strategies. CHP, I think everyone knows, is an integrated energy system. Utilizes commercially available technology to efficiently generate electricity or mechanical power and useful thermal energy from a single source of fuel. And most importantly, this generation is done at or close to the point of use. It's a cost-effective energy efficiency resource. It's available and exists in all states. In fact, there are over 4,200 existing CHP systems operating today, and they offer a host of air quality, economic, and energy reliability benefits, not the least of which is cost-effective CO2 reductions from the grid. Because of these benefits, many states are already promoting CHP development through state efficiency and clean energy programs. And as this report hopefully demonstrates, CHP can be one of the efficiency measures that states can use as part of their compliance program, and a measure that states can know up front will get approval from EPA if the programs are properly designed and implemented. I'm sure almost everyone has seen charts like this before, but I just thought it was useful to remind folks how properly designed CHP systems can provide significant energy efficiency and environmental advantages over separate heat and power. You know, an on-site boiler, purchasing power from the grid in order to get your energy services at your factory or building. CHP's efficiency advantage really comes from recovering the heat normally lost in power generation to provide useful heating and cooling on-site. This inherent higher efficiency and the elimination of transmission and distribution losses in getting power from the central power plant to the user really generally results in lower overall energy use and lower carbon emissions in providing needed energy services to the users. And as I said, there are currently about 4,200 installations of CHP across the United States. They represent 83 gigawatts of electric capacity. This is about 8% of U.S. generating capacity and actually provides about 12% of total U.S. megawatt generation. And this existing fleet is avoiding about 1.8 quadrillion BTUs of fuel consumption currently on an annual basis. And that fuel efficiency, that fuel savings, is what results in reductions of CO2 emissions of anywhere from 30 to 55% due to CHP in most regions of the country. This, how the extent of the CO2 reductions depends on the efficiency of the CHP system, the fuel type used in CHP system, and the efficiency in the fuel mix of the displaced boiler and avoided central station generation. But in most regions of the country, CHP would represent a significant CO2 savings. And in fact, the 83 gigawatts of existing CHP capacity is estimated to be avoiding about 240 million tons of CO2 annually today. So you can see it's already a huge resource in terms of greenhouse gases. In terms of life cycle costs, also CHP can be an extremely cost-effective resource for states looking for a new electricity supply. This is sort of another life cycle cost similar to what Ken put up. But this chart is from the 2014 version of the Bloomberg Sustainable Energy Factbook, and it shows the levelized cost of electricity across a wide range of traditional generation and emerging clean energy resources for power. And you can see natural gas circled down there at the bottom. It's natural gas CHP based on a commercially available gas turbine system. And the levelized cost compares quite favorably to the alternative resources. So CHP can be a very cost-effective resource for the states. And finally, I think it's important to note that the additional potential for new CHP is large in the U.S. and is present in every state. ISC has done most of the work in this area. They've evaluated CHP markets for DOE and others, and they estimate that the technical potential for CHP is on the order of 130 gigawatts. Remember, there's 83 gigawatts installed. And that 130 is split pretty evenly between industrial and commercial and institutional applications. And given that the current suite of 83 gigawatts represents 240 million tons of CO2 savings, the potential impact from the technical potential of CHP, at least, is quite large. And again, CHP provides an available resource for every state in the United States. There are CHP systems operating in each state. But as a practical matter, you can see here that the potential is greater for some states than others. And some of the greatest potential just happens to be in states that have greater reliance on coal-fired power and some of the more challenging proposed emissions reduction targets under at least the proposed Clean Power Plan rule. So, again, it's just a sense that CHP could have be a good resource for compliance to the power plan. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the report that was just released. This is the table of contents from the report. The report really is intended, as I said, to provide guidance, information, and resources that states can use to evaluate CHP as a compliance measure, and if warranted, help them develop plans or a pathway for incorporating CHP as part of their overall compliance plan. So the report includes a fairly thorough overview of CHP markets, applications, and benefits, going a little bit more deeper than the slides I just saw. It includes a look at how CHP can provide CO2 savings under either a mass-based or rate-based approach to compliance. It then examines how EPA and state air agencies might treat CHP under each of the four general approvability criteria EPA has said it will use to evaluate state compliance plans. And these include enforceability, performance, is it measurable and quantifiable, and accountability. There is a section that details the key steps a state can take to evaluate and configure CHP as a compliance module. And the final section of the body of the report itself is sort of a basic outline of the suggested elements of a CHP compliance pathway, essentially the sections that would need to be included in a plan for a CHP pathway. And it squares very well with the ACEEE pathway that Negan talked about. The report also includes four appendices. The appendices include two compendiums of detailed information or resources. One is a menu. You see it at the top, a menu or tabulation of policy options that states have successfully adopted to encourage development of CHP. And the second, notified as key resources on the bottom, it contains a brief description and URLs for a long list of key resources relevant to CHP, including sort of milestone reports, calculators, databases, and the likes like that, all information that could help a state understand what the potential is in their area and what CHP might mean for their compliance plan. There are also, in appendices, two sections that go into important topics in greater detail. The first is an in-depth discussion of the enforceability criteria as it relates to a CHP compliance pathway. Again, enforceability is one of the four general criteria by which EPA will approve or disapprove a compliance plan. And this section discusses how a CHP pathway might be treated in terms of enforceability under several different approaches to compliance, including EGU-based compliance plan, a portfolio plan, a state commitment plan, or complementary measures. The second in-depth topic is a discussion of how emissions reductions from CHP can be quantified and verified in accordance with expected EPA requirements. Like other energy efficiency investments, CHP deployed at an industrial facility ends up reducing electricity demand and therefore emissions from affected ETUs, electric generating units. As such, the methodology used for crediting emissions reductions from CHP really should be equivalent to the methodology used for crediting other end-use efficiency measures. However, unlike traditional end-use efficiency, implementation of CHP often results in incremental fuel use and incremental CO2 emissions at the host facility. We think it's highly likely that EPA is going to require that these incremental emissions be taken into account in determining the emissions reductions achieved through CHP. And this section in the appendix really goes through in some detail how those incremental emissions can be estimated and how the net savings could be calculated under various scenarios based on those incorporating those incremental emissions. Now, in today's webinar, there's really not the time to go through any of these sections in detail. As Jennifer suggested, we'd be happy to answer questions or discuss any reports information offline. But I do want to take the next four or five slides very quickly to just talk about some key takeaways in the report. The report really is based on the fact that a menu of approaches is going to be needed to accommodate the diversity and state preferences in existing policies, in industrial base and commercial base that they have, and the CHP potential in the state. And it's also based on the fact that the power plan really presents an opportunity to both expand successful existing efforts and to try something new. So that in outlining its general approach to design of a compliance plan, you know, we start with building on really as a first step to look for ways to improve, expand, or modify your existing efficiency programs, incorporate CHP into them if it's not already incorporated. And if you don't have programs in place like that, look to other states for some best practices and program models. But under the power plan, we think that carbon reduction is really going to have an economic value. So part of the key in promoting energy efficiency and CHP as part of the power compliance plan may be to design policy supports or market structures that capture that value in a way that expands private investment in energy efficiency and CHP. And I think the existence of this new value could create opportunities for CHP in medium and large industrials where they're not sometimes don't attract or participation in ratepayer programs or in institutional sectors. I think a more market-based approach might have greater success in some of these markets where a large industrial customer might be attracted to a market structure that sort of channels the carbon reduction revenues through either standard offers from affected utilities, state or regional certification processes that with national or regional registries, layering emission credits on top of the utility program incentives. There are all sorts of options that you can envision what that could be more market-based and encourage CHP investment outside of existing ratepayer programs. This diagram focuses on one of the key decisions that states will need to make up front in designing a compliance plan, and it's the decision between going rate-based or mass-based standards. What we try to do in the report is point out that CHP really works under any of these combinations. Under a rate-based approach, states will have specific emissions rate targets, pounds per megawatt hour, that must be met over time. When thermal output is properly accounted, you know, well-designed, properly operated CHP systems will be generating electricity at a lower effective emissions rate than most affected EGUs and proposed state targets. So CHP can generate emissions reduction credits in that manner that can help states or affected EGUs meet their goals. CHP could directly derive value for its emissions reductions, as I just talked about, under a rate-based approach, either through direct incentives or to stimulate CHP investment or through market-based mechanisms that again, allow affected entities to purchase certified savings credits from an emissions registry or directly from an end-use customer that installed CHP. Under a mass-based approach, the state's rate-based emissions targets are converted into an overall emissions limit expressed in tons of terms of annual tons of CO2 release. CHP deployment would reduce the need for power generated from the grid, thereby lowering the emissions from affected EGUs. So again, there should be ways CHP could be incentivized through existing state or ratepayer programs or through allowance set asides and cap and trade programs that might be set up similar to REGI. As I said earlier, the report addresses how CHP could be handled in each of the four general criteria EPA will use for evaluating a state compliance plan. Our feeling is that a CHP module would be part of a suite of strategies projected to meet the emissions rate or mass-based target for a state. And it's the combined effect of all these components, all these measures together that really is compared to and gets you to the goals. Given this, what we think is likely to be enforceable are really the emission targets in the plan itself and not the particulars of any given module to get to those targets, such as a CHP module or energy efficiency module. It's the state emissions limits that we think will be enforceable or most likely be enforceable. But again, there needs to be accountability under the EPA requirements. You need to have a mechanism to monitor and report on implementation progress, and you have to have a plan for corrective actions if parts of the portfolio or sections of the strategies are underperforming. And this may mean revamping programs to bolster a specific measure or ramping up efforts in other areas to really compensate for underperformance in other areas. And so I think our key takeaway on this is that it's not likely that the individual emissions reduction measures or strategies are going to be enforceable, or that an individual site putting in a CHP system is going to be under enforcement, but it's the goal itself and these strategies, these measures are combined by the state into getting to that goal. There does have to be an acceptable plan for measuring, quantifying, and verifying savings. And I think this is an area where CHP is at an advantage. There are established protocols for EM&V for CHP. A number of states have some very detailed approaches to measuring CHP performance and savings, and all these can be referenced in state plans and would likely meet the sort of conditions of EPA approvals for EM&V. Finally, I mentioned that in the appendix that there was a sampling of successful policies that states have adopted to encourage deployment of CHP. These policies reflect a wide array of options available to states, and what we've tried to do is provide some initial background and resources to enable other states to learn from this experience. And what we've done is organize the policies and actions into these categories. We look at financing. CHP projects can be extremely upfront capital intensive, and states and utilities have adopted a wide variety of financial supports for CHP, including grants, loans, utility rebates, state bonds, tax credits. Regulatory relief is an issue. CHP installations are complex projects. They trigger a variety of permitting and approval requirements. And there's a number of things states can do to encourage projects by offering regulatory assistance, by streamlining permitting, by ensuring standby rates are properly designed to cover legitimate costs for the utility, but not structured in a way that hinders CHP development. And finally, in market support, states can do a lot, I think, to help create a market for clean and efficient electricity from CHP through state portfolio standards, requiring consideration of CHP when critical infrastructure is built or renovated that belongs to the states, things like that. And again, Appendix A includes a long list of these options and with descriptions and places to go for additional information. To end my remarks, there have been a number of issues that have been discussed for months about CHP and the Clean Power Plan. We've tried to address these issues in the report from many different angles, but I think still some uncertainties remain out there. I think a lot of them will be clarified very soon, maybe even as soon as next week. I suspect The final rule and the draft federal implementation plan will probably go a long way toward providing specific guidance on the first two here. How do you calculate CHP incremental emissions, and what displaced grid emissions value do you use to calculate the CO2 savings? And secondly, what will be required in terms of acceptable EM&V data requirements and monitoring? And it'll be much easier to see how CHP specifically fits in once that those things are clarified. But I also think the information in this report will be useful in better understanding what this final EPA guidance means and helping states get comfortable in knowing what the numbers are, how the estimates need to be quantified, and how you can get there once these parameters are identified, such as displaced emissions rate. And then the third bullet listed here, how can my state encourage CHP investment so a CHP compliance pathway and is a good resource? I think the report provides a host of examples of policies, programs, and actions that have worked in other states. Again, this list is not prescriptive. There are a lot of things that aren't suitable in every state, but I think it's a chance to look at some initial background and resources and what others have tried to see how your state could move CHP forward as part of its compliance plan. With that, I'm going to return the helm to Jennifer. But first I want to hear some information. Jennifer Kiefer and myself, and the report can be found at the URL posted there. I also believe it's up on the David Gardner & Associates website as well. Jennifer?
Wonderful. So first of all, thank you to all of our presenters for a very informative presentation. I've received questions from a number of you about availability of slides. We will make both the slides and a recording of today's webinar available to folks. If you did not register via Eventbrite, again, please just drop me a note, and my email address, along with those of all of the presenters, is on the screen. Additionally, we've received a number of questions. We've got about 6 minutes right now, make that five, to cover them. I'll see how much ground we can cover right now, and anything we don't address, we'll be sure to take up with folks offline. So my first question, which is maybe a question around Robin, let's start with Ken. And again, if people can go quickly, because we do have a number with their responses, because we do have a number of questions. What should participants do next? We've laid out a lot of tools and recommended that states include energy efficiency and industrial efficiency in their plans. What's the next step for the people on this line, which includes a very mixed audiences, as I think Bruce flagged a moment ago?
Sure. Thanks, Jen. I think the next step is probably the most obvious one, which is when the final rule does come out, to review it in some detail with an eye toward the efficiency sections, several of which were highlighted by the panelists here. I anticipate that the rule will have a significant appear significantly different from the proposal, not only in obvious numerical senses like state targets, but probably in more macro aspects as well. And so the take-home I would offer is simply get your arms quickly around what those changes mean against the understanding that you've already developed over the last year on the proposed rules, so that you can proceed with considering what options are most valid and having conversations with stakeholders and framing up your planning process to submit the initial plan.
Great. Megan, do you have something to add? If not, I'll put you in the hot seat in a moment with the next question, so you should feel free to skip as well.
I'll wait for the next question.
All righty. And Bruce, did you have anything you wanted to add to Ken's feedback?
No, I agree with Ken. I think the real key is to find out what those changes are and see how that impacts, you know, what you've already been thinking and planning.
Great.
So far.
Thank you. Then move on to a few questions that came in from Megan. One, I think, is just a clarification. In the super sweet slide, part of the savings shown were simply labeled energy savings target. What does super estimate to be used for the energy savings targets?
Sure. So That essentially is analogous to an energy efficiency resource standard. That's what we mean by annual energy savings target. And in the slide, I chose the 1.5% per year through 2030 option. There's also a 1% per year option. And Super also allows those savings to ramp up gradually. And in the tool, we assume that each state adopts a savings target that ramps up at a rate of about 0.25% per year.
Wonderful. One more question that I want to share with you. Now, on the ACEEE Super tool, does the tool suggest the most cost-effective approaches and how? So is there any assessment of cost or simply capacity?
Sure. So that's a good question. Super is not a dispatch model like some of the other tools out there for compliance that, optimize measures based on the lowest cost to meet the load. But it does provide estimates for how much measures are going to cost, and it allows you to kind of compare the costs of one to another. So I would encourage you to look at the user guide for more, which accompanies the Excel tool, and you can see how we calculate costs for the different options.
Thank you. Bruce, I want to turn to you. First question is perhaps more of a comment, but I'd love you to be able to expand briefly. One participant asked if you could elaborate on the resiliency and reliability benefits of CHP. That's something that I think was maybe enumerated as a benefit but not addressed.
Yeah, no, I think this is one of the key benefits of CHP. And in fact, it's interesting to me that energy efficiency in general provides a lot of ancillary benefits besides just CO2 reductions. And CHP in particular, was shown in Northeast and Superstorm Sandy, easy for me to say, and other storms, it really can play a critical role in resiliency for the critical infrastructure. Universities, hospitals that have CHP systems in place stayed up through days of outages, power outages around them, and served as places of refuge for people that needed it. Some systems in different outages have been used to bring the grid back up. So there are all sorts of infrastructure reliability and infrastructure, critical infrastructure support benefits from a lot of CHP systems that when designed properly for black start and standalone operation.
Wonderful. I'm going to close with just one more question also for you, Bruce. It looks like we're at the top of the hour, but I'm hoping we can squeeze this in. And that is, which states have the most deployed CHP, and what have they done best? Perhaps how can they serve as a model to others?
It's a mix. There's a lot of CHP in the states that have industrial loads. So California, Texas, Louisiana has a lot of large industrial CHP. But presently, there's a lot of activity in new CHP in the Northeast states, still in California and Texas, but in a lot of states where they're beginning to recognize some of these ancillary benefits of CHP, the efficiency benefits of CHP, and they've put programs in to try and help really the market deployment in CHP. So in Massachusetts, in Maryland, in New York, in Illinois has a pilot program as part of the DCEO energy program. You're starting to see some market activity and real interest in promoting CHP as a low-cost resource.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much to everybody for joining our call today. I hope you learned a lot from it. I know we covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time, so we will be following up with those slides so you can dig into them a little closer. We also have everyone's contact information included in that slide deck, so you should feel free to take this conversation offline and turn it into more of a dialogue. I hope I'm not speaking out of school when I say that all of us would love to be a resource to your states as you move forward with figuring out how can you incorporate energy efficiency into compliance plans. Thank you so much again for your time, and we will be in touch.
That does conclude our conference for today. We thank you for your participation.